It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This weekend, the Des Moines Metropolitan Opera begins a new season, and for the first time in the company's history, we'll be performing a 21st century opera. Dead Man Walking is the fictional story of a Louisiana man, Joseph de Rocher, sentenced to death for his role in the murders of two people. And in the opera's prologue, the killing of a young couple takes place on a summer night. Most of the opera is set in prison. The character, de Rocher, is on death row when he meets a nun. At first, he's defensive and uninterested in her visits, but soon they become very close. The last scene of the opera is set in the execution chamber, when de Rocher is strapped to a gurney, and when asked if he has any final words, he addresses the victims' families.
I want to ask the parents' forgiveness for what I did. I did a terrible thing, taking your children from you. And I would just like to say that I hope you get some relief from my death.
Proceed.
For the next minute, we hear the machines injecting the lethal dose. A beeping represents de Rocher's heartbeat until it flatlines and he's dead. The story for Dead Man Walking is based on a book by the same name. Sister Helen Prejean wrote about her experiences working with men on death row and accompanying them to the execution chamber. Sister Prejean spoke with my colleague, Iowa Public Radio's John Pemble, about her work advocating against the death penalty and how that 30-year journey began.
It was the actual witnessing of Patrick Saunier's execution, the first man I wrote letters to and visited, and then he was killed in the electric chair, and I was there. Because to be brought close to the experience of saying, okay, the theory of the death penalty is some people deserve the death penalty. He had truly participated and done a terrible crime. But it's the witnessing of that death that changed my life forever. And in fact, I'm writing a book now on the spiritual journey that led me to death row in the first place. And in the preface to the book, I begin with that experience that unleashed everything for me. They killed a man with fire one night, strapped him in a wooden chair, and pumped electricity through his body until he was dead. His killing was a legal act because he had killed. No religious leaders protested the killing that night, but I was there. I saw it with my own eyes, and what I saw set my soul on fire. And I came out of that execution chamber, and I couldn't just walk away. I couldn't say, there's the death penalty. But I knew that I had been brought in as a witness, and I had to tell the story.
How old of a person were you when you saw this first execution?
I was in my early 40s.
What were you like before that?
I was your good nun. I was pious and prayerful and taught children. Did not beat them with rulers to teach them about the love of God, whap, whap, whap. And I loved teaching, taught religion in English to middle school kids, but then also in a high school. Then awakened to a deeper dimension of actually the gospel of Jesus that Pope Francis is representing to us so much more now, of being out there with the marginated. Realized I wasn't participating in any kind of way in justice. I was being charitable to people, and I was praying for God to change the world. But I moved into the St. Thomas Housing Projects. And it was a short grease rail then of going to prison, because while I was there, I got an invitation one day. I was working at a place called Hope House, And a friend who worked with the Louisiana Coalition on Jails and Prisons said, hey, Sister Helen, you want to write a letter to a death row inmate in Louisiana? And I said, sure. And I wrote a letter. And everything came out of writing that letter.
You've witnessed 6 executions. And this was your first.
Yes.
What execution is this opera about?
The opera represents everybody executed, because it just is going to embody and make very clear somebody who actually does a very unspeakable murder. And the opera makes it clear, the prologue of the opera is the witnessing of the murder of 2 innocent young people. And we know who did it, so we're not going to use any moral energy. Did he do it or not? And if he's guilty, he deserves death. We know he did it. And I shared it. Once you put a book out there, a book has legs. A book is like a child. A book goes where it wants to go. And it went into the hands of Susan Sarandon first, who persuaded Tim Robbins to do the film of Dead Man Walking, so the film comes out. And then one day I get a call. Hey, Helen, they want to do an opera. And I said, yes, because I could immediately picture that opera is really the fullness of art, because it's live drama, but it's also music that brings you and guides you as you go along on the journey. And I knew, because the book is written that way, it's going to bring people over to both sides of the suffering, the victim's family on the one hand. Here's the perpetrator who did the crime, who also has a mother. And I could picture that opera, if they could get the right people to do it, it could be done very well. And you have to trust your artist. It happened with the movie. I turned the book over to Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins to do. And when it came to the opera, I turned it over to Jake Heggie, the composer, Terrence McNally, the playwright, and said, guys, go do your stuff. You got to give artists freedom to create, and you have to trust them. And I did, and they did this job, which is coming to Des Moines, and people will get to experience for themselves.
In the movie and the opera, Dead Man Walking, you are depicted by other women. It's about you from 3 decades ago. When you see others playing you, is it like looking back in time when you see yourself on a stage? What's the difference between seeing someone singing the role of Helen Prejean and the woman that is here with me today in the studio?
Well, it's not really in the past, because I continue to accompany somebody on death row. And there's a man on death row in Louisiana today, Manuel Ortiz. I'm always going back onto death row. And so it's an ongoing thing. And but the seeing of myself, it's probably the question I get asked the most. It's really not about me. I'm kind of the vehicle for the story. And people accompany me, actually, on my own journey of going over to both sides and trying to balance this rage we feel, outrage, which I believe is ethical. When an innocent person is violated and killed, we feel outrage, and we should feel outrage. And then on the other hand, to say now, what does it mean that we, as the people of the United States, are in a particular state, say, in my name, yep, go ahead and kill the one who kill the other one, and with my blessing. And what does that mean for us? Or can we go to another place?
Here's an excerpt from the opera. It's a scene where you meet a man on death row for the first time, and he's trying to make you feel uncomfortable by saying things that may be unsettling.
I love the ladies, I miss them, I do. That's the worst part about this place. You're all alone that way, too.
How much of this happens when you're visiting someone who is in a desperate situation during a prison ministry scenario?
There is this distancing at first, And there is a dynamic of a woman going to see a man and accompany a man at a very intimate, close personal level. And I'm always very conscious of that with people on death row because they do not have access to conversations with women or any kind of depth. But you have to gain each other's trust, basically, is what it amounts to. And so there's always that in the journey, always. And so you start with this, and they, you know, there's a bit of testing. Can I trust you? You know, what do nuns know about this stuff? But it doesn't happen. It doesn't last long because people on death row are so abandoned, so alone, condemned to death, judged to be so terrible they have to be killed by society. And here's a person who comes steadily, faithfully, who cares for them, and the trust builds.
In this opera, there's a turning point between Sister Helen and the man on death row. He becomes vulnerable. When you minister men on death row, is this kind of turning point typical? When does it happen?
There are a lot of points of contact you hope to make to be able to acknowledge that they are afraid, because a macho thing kicks into this too. And you have different individuals. The second person I was with on death row, Robert Lee Willie, in his identity, he was an outlaw. And he said, "The electric chair don't scare me, man." And he actually walked to the electric chair with this little bounce in his step and winked at me from the chair, like, "I'm going to out-tough them." And so it's all mixed up. And basically, you know, they're trying to preserve their dignity, that they want their legs to hold them up. They don't want to faint. And so, but the acknowledging of fear is a point of deep trust when they can do that and just say, "Okay, I'm really scared. What's this going to be like? It's going to hurt. It's going to," and I just try to stand there honestly with them because I'm scared too. And especially the first person I was with in the death house for 3 days before they killed him and like ratcheting toward this point of death. It was surreal. It was unreal. And I was terrified. And actually depending on them in a way, because if they had broken down emotionally, I was hanging by a thread. And my only private place to go in the death house in a Louisiana killing place is in the women's room. And I would go in there to just gather myself together and just say, "God, please help me. Please don't let him break down." It was a selfish prayer. "Please don't let him break down, or I'm going to break down too." And so it did get to be like a mutual holding of each other up, especially for the first one, Patrick Saunier. And he'd say, "Sister Helen, are you all right? Are you okay?" Patrick Saunier said, "I don't want you to see this at the end because it could scar you. Just pray for me that God holds up my legs as I go." And then my saying to him, "There is no way you're going to die without at least one face among those witnesses that cares about you and sees your dignity as a person. And when this happens, you look at me when they do this, and I'll be the face of love for you." And he was Christian. "I'll be the face of Christ for you. I'll be there. Look at me." And that's what happened.
Is that then when you break down after it's over?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Vomited. I had been with people, you know, who have died, like in hospitals, our older sisters, and you can see a human being fading and beginning to leave. They're not talking, they're not eating. But like speaking with Patrick the First, all of them, they're talking, they're drinking coffee, and we're talking like we always talk because they're fully alive. And the only way you know they're going to die is with your mind and your watch. "Oh, my goodness, we're 2 hours away. It's 1 hour away." And he's doing that, too. He goes, "Oh, man, the time's racing." And the time was unlike any other time I ever experienced. It's like it stopped, and it was racing because you're moving toward the last moments of his life. The conversations about the huge stuff, about reaching it to the other side, and their own spiritual journey of coming to grips and owning what they have done, their relationship with God, entrusting their life over, that mercy would find them on the other side. And then you're talking about very ordinary things, like how his mama made venison stew and how she made the gravy. With Robert Lee Willie, it was working on a barge in Louisiana, coming down the Mississippi River, and the way it was at night with the lights on the river. And then, oh my God, what time is it? And we're ratcheting toward the end.
Iowa is not a state where the death penalty is legal, but it is in Oklahoma. In April, at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary, an execution that should have taken less than 10 minutes took 43 minutes. Has this event in Oklahoma changed the conversation about capital punishment in the United States this year?
One of the things it has done, because the Danish company that was sending the main drug to kill people found out their drug was being used to kill people and stopped the drug. And so you have states now scurrying around to get the drugs, and that's what happened in Oklahoma. And it has been what the execution of Clayton Lockett in Oklahoma showed was, it has been a non-transparent process all the way. We haven't known what states used, what drugs they used, who were the technicians, as they call them, capable. Once you start using a medicinal, medical way to kill people, to insert the needles, to do all of those things, we haven't known. There's been more transparency about the euthanizing of animals. What drugs are you using? What's the source? Are they out of date or not? Who are the people doing this? What's the process you're using? And we have not had it for the killing of human beings. And in my opinion, having accompanied six people to execution, the fact that our Supreme Court is saying it's not against your constitutional rights to kill a human being, that it's not an act of cruelty to take a conscious, imaginative person and kill them, is botched. It's a botched or skewed concept that we actually have never been able to apply across the board. And they've thrown it over to the states to administer, which comes down to the discretion of DAs to go for the death penalty or not. And then that whole method of execution and who's done it is behind prison walls. People are not close. There have been three attempts to make executions public. It was brought, it were court cases. They decided against it. For very interesting reasons sometimes, like, oh, well, the person being killed has a right to privacy. Or for the public to see this could have a coarsening effect. Well, if we're calling it justice, a coarsening effect to witness an act of justice being done. So the secrecy that's been around it and the hiddenness of it, even the fact that we move from hanging to electrocution to lethal injection, trying to make it look more and more, in quotes, humane. There is no humane way to take a conscious, imaginative being, put them in a cell, condemn them to death, where they ratchet toward the time of their death, and then they're taken out and killed. There is no humane way to do this. So in a way, the botched execution is bringing out, I think, the problems inherent in the whole process.
So do you think this opera serves as pretty much the only means that the public has to witness an execution in this country?
It is. And when I came out of that killing chamber that night, 1984, I remember thinking, we got to find a way to bring people close to this. And there's no closer way of coming to an execution than having it right there before you. And Jake Hagee, the composer, as the execution is happening, all we hear is the sound of the machines. It's the only opera with a minute and a half of silence. So we have to attend. Okay. The act of justice is now happening, and the man who did that terrible murder that we witnessed in the beginning is now getting justice, and we're brought close to it. And that's what the arts do for us. They open us up and bring us close to things in a way we wouldn't otherwise have a way of going. And I remember as I was writing Dead Man Walking, because see, when you read in your imagination, you're going through the scenes. You're living it. You're experiencing it. And I knew it would be a way to bring people close to this, because the deeper we can go into reflection on some of the deep moral issues of our time, the quicker we get to our deeper hearts of it. In the beginning, it may seem impossible to say, I cannot countenance that I can say the person who did this deserves to live. And then we get brought close into the process of actually watching him be killed. And that's what art is about, to bring us into the heart of things in a way. And the beauty of the opera is because you have the live drama happening there, and the music, the resonance of the music that is bringing us to places of our heart. And music has a way of bringing us to places we in our heart we don't even know we have. And it's done masterfully. I couldn't ask for it to be done better than it's being done.
Sister Helen Prejean, thank you.
Thank you.
Iowa Public Radio's John Pemble in conversation with Sister Helen Prejean.
He will gather us around, all around. He will gather us around.
And that brings us to the end of today's program. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Of course, a big thanks today to my colleague John Pemble. Also, thanks to Jacqueline Hallbloom. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio, podcasting and on-demand audio of our program, available anytime by going to iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.